crab victim.
Oh, I see, crab victim, okay. So, have you sent me a friend request?
Yeah, you asked him. And you know,
I see. Okay, right. So, let me add you to the conference. It went live like this, so... Conference invite. Now, be in visible mode, please, guys. Whoever is on the call, be in the visible mode. Otherwise, there's just so many people on my list. It's hard to
subscribe. Oh, yeah.
Aman 4988, are you on the call, Aman? Probably not.
Yeah, here's the thing. I'm going to have you.
Oh, you're here? Okay. I'll Aman, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, I can add you to the conference as well. Okay, who all is not in the conference? Okay, Aman, I will add you. And who else is not on the conference? Middle of nowhere, you are on the conference now?
Yes, I am.
On the Yahoo Messenger conference, I mean.
Yeah.
This is Sumit. I'm not in the
Sumit, add me as a friend, man.
Oh, yeah, no, I am.
You are actually on the friend. Okay, I'm inviting you.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. So I'll send some more invitations. Okay, guys, I'll be back in 2 minutes, okay?
Meanwhile, whilst we're waiting, I have a question for those whose wives have abducted their children. If you haven't managed to get a warrant issued or something, how else are you dealing with the situation? How do you expect to get your children back otherwise? Hello?
Hello, yes. This is Anand from California.
Okay, Anand.
My wife is in India with 2 children. She has run away, and she tried to run away.
No, I know all that story. I'm just asking
but
you.
But I'm trying
question.
To develop. I'm trying to figure out what can be my ways to by to access any legal course from listening to these people because I'm very ignorant on this. How to approach? I'm just listening other people and trying to.
Right, because remember, the longer you leave it, the more difficult it becomes to get the local legal authorities to help you.
I see.
Okay, because everything is time-barred. So if you leave it for too long, they're not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. So you have to, within a certain number of, days, months, weeks, whatever, you have to go and file. And then take that forward and push it as much as you can, because there is nothing else. You know, okay, you know, sort of, you can go to the press, you can do everything else, but that's not going to help you get your children back.
Do you think officially sending in a letter from a lawyer, will that help for her to remind her or ask her to return or come back here?
No, no, it won't do anything.
I see.
A waste of time.
Uh-huh.
If you
think she's going
to respond to a lawyer's letter, she wouldn't have taken the children in the first place.
So, do I have to generate some evidence that it is abduction, like physical evidence, like I'm calling or asking her to...
No, I mean, if you somehow you have, you know, I mean, in a sense, if you're married, whatever, you in a sense, you have joint custody, right? She took your children away from you, and, you know, that's it. So you want to file a police complaint because she took your children away and you don't know where she went and she's not responding. You've called the parents. They claim they don't know where she is. And so on and so forth. You know, you just go with that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, and, you know, that's it. You know, you say that, you know, she took your children and, you know, I guess, you know, she took them to India and you can't find her. You don't know what to do. So you want to, you know, go through the legal process. And you can't go through the legal process unless they do the paperwork over here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She can't just suddenly arrive in India without any paperwork, and what are you going to fight on? Then they'll say, okay, India's jurisdiction, come and fight in India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, the one idea I had in joining was trying to understand from you people's experience that how to move in this, because I'm quite ignorant, inexperienced. I'm learning now from you people that how should I actually go ahead and do certain things and develop some confidence in doing certain things.
Well, there's nothing to be learned, because each of us learned by doing it. You have to use every possible means, you know, to take your case forward.
That she has been threatening for the 498
all that
will surely find it.
Every woman's going to do that. Who does your children is going to do that. If she gets a chance. So why are we going to even worry about the threat? The threats will always be there. So she will do what she has to do, or she wants to do, and do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pointless going over, you know, she's been calling me, she's been threatening me, she's been sending me text messages. But, you know, it has no value whatsoever. And it's pointless, you know, telling your story to 20 different people. How would that help you? Only you can help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can do it is, you know, by trying every possible channel.
Uh-huh.
You've tried to communicate with her. She doesn't respond. So what do you do? I mean, you have, you know, I mean, one option, you can go back there and, you know, beg her to come back and, you know, give you access to your children and, you know, maybe it'll that work.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it won't. If you're scared that she's going to file a 498, maybe she will.
Uh-huh.
There are no guarantees. There's no certainty. So that is why, you know, I mean, like, nobody can really advise you. Only you know your own situation. Okay? You know, what to fear, what not to fear. And it's pointless anybody else trying to, you know, guide you along without knowing all the details.
Hello. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
There are always sort of, you know, I mean, intricate.
Hello, can you hear me?
We're getting an echo, guys. What's up?
Satya, is it?
Yeah, Satya is here.
I think the echo could be because of the speakerphone that we're using. Do you think it's possible?
No, I don't hear anything. I think the reception is just too good.
I don't know. I'm getting an echo.
I am getting an echo.
Speakerphone or what?
Yeah, actually, it's affecting two other people. So, that's why.
Okay, I'm muting my phone. Tell me if the echo goes away, okay?
Do you guys see any?
You know what, Andy? The thing is that if everyone who is not going to speak mutes their system, then that should work perfectly well.
Yeah, I think he's right. Anyone who is speaking only should have the speaker phone on or whatever. Others should mute their phone.
Yeah, that will work.
Actually, Satya, I am recording this whole seminar, so I have to keep my speakerphone on. Hello, this is Dinesh.
If you are recording something, you don't have to keep your speakerphone on.
No, then how can I am going to record it?
Which is external, that's why probably he doesn't have something which is hooking to his phone.
Okay, yeah. Now, who is this?
This is Dinesh.
Oh, Dinesh, you are recording it?
Yes, I'm trying to record it, yeah. I started after 12. It's CST time 12. So probably it's PST will be 10. I can switch off my speaker. That's fine.
If you are recording, you can still keep it mute, so feedback will not go back into the conference.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Is it okay now?
Ramesh.
Hi, Ramesh. This is Ren.
Oh, okay, I'm connecting with the conference. Okay, so I'm conferencing you. He gave the phone on, and I'm conferencing you.
She jumps jurisdiction from the US away, comes to India. in the country of residence does not exist in India. Parental abduction is not seen as a crime in India. Most of these children, like I said, are citizens of the United States, and often the father has restraining orders from the court in the United States, which say that the child cannot be removed from the country, by which the wife takes the children, runs away to India, and because in India, parental abduction is not a crime. U.S. court orders are very conveniently ignored in India. It is not seen something that the Indian government or the courts have to comply with, even if there is a restraining order in the U.S. court, that can be conveniently ignored. In almost all the cases, when the husband contests the case and wants child custody, then the wife resorts to misuse of laws like 498. What then happens is that a civil case, which, is very conveniently converted into a criminal case. In under 498, you know that there are very stringent rules. If the husband comes to India, he's likely to be arrested, his passport impounded. So this is a very convenient way of ensuring that the husband is unable to come to India and unable to fight for custody of his children. All the aged parents, senior citizens, young children, the entire family of the non-resident Indian in India is harassed because of the misuse of these forms. It does not matter that they never were in the United States, that they never lived with the couple, they are not capable of having caused any harassment from 8,000 miles away. Irrespective, the entire family is jailed and harassed without an iota of evidence. The wife is not expected to leave any evidence in order to prove her case. In most cases, the victims are not even allowed to participate in the investigation process. It's the police which decides on its own and gives an investigation.
Can you hear
me? Having the
foreign
family
right now.
The paternal side of the Indian family, of course, completely loses contact with their child. By court orders, abusive women do not comply with orders because there is no penalty if you do not comply with court orders. There is no penalty for perjury, there is no penalty for violence. Adultery, you may know that in India, even in adultery, the woman has never been alive. So there is no penalty for women who misuse these laws. Even if they lie, even if they perjure, even if they are false accusations, even if they commit fraud, there is absolutely flashback for doing so. Now, according to the UN Convention on Rights for the Child, the state should ensure that the identity of the child is retained and he or she remains in constant touch with both parents. Indian courts are either indifferent or are oblivious of the noble articles enshrined in the convention. And here I would like to add that it's not just non-resident Indians who, because of distance, cannot see their children. Even in India, even when the court gives the men visitation rights, often the wives do not comply by those rights. And men and men's families in India itself lose contact with their children. Because there is absolutely nothing to make these women comply by the court order. Left behind parents have lost contact with their children, and in many cases, children are subjected to severe mental abuse. Start exhibiting symptoms of parental syndrome. What is the sequence of child abduction? First, the child gets abducted. In most cases, I would say in 99% of the cases, it is the woman who would flee with the children to India. Sometimes, in a small percentage of cases, it is true that men have also fled with their children. But like I said, in 99% of cases, it is the woman who would flee with the children. If the abductor is the NRI mother, the child is not returned to the NRI father despite foreign court orders granting him full court custody. Even if there has been a custody battle in the United States, even if the court has given the custody to the father, the wife is likely to run away with the children to India and would not comply by the court order which has been passed by the foreign court. If the father contests the case in India, very quickly, court cases like 498 Kaiti and several other allegations are leveled against him and his family in order to prevent them from fighting the custody case. The family gets arrested, it includes elders and children alike. By converting a criminal, a civil case to a criminal case, fathers are prevented from entering India and the threat of arrest is very large and they're not forced to get out of the state. Basically, what that will do is destroy the life that he's made for himself in a foreign country. The courts do not ensure that the child remains in contact with his father and the best interest of the child is ignored. However, as happened recently, you may recall, if the NRI father is the abductor, then the Indian courts very quickly return the child to the NRI mother based on joint custody orders from foreign court. And the Ministry of Home Affairs or Foreigners Regional Registration Office helped by not extending the abductor or the child's visa, so that he's forced to send the child back. Now, I just very briefly talked about how this entire process of law is being supported and being withdrew. What we would like now try and do is try and get you to talk to these NRI men directly through video conference. So we have a few case studies and we try and get these NRIs on board. Okay, Andy?
Yes.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, so we'll try and get the pictures now and then we'll get the audio through the phone. Yeah? Sandeep's working on the... Yeah.
Hello?
In my services. In my... Okay, Sandeep's just trying to get the video, and then we can start with Saurabh's case?
Yes, please start with Saurabh's case. His webcam is already available.
Okay. So we'll just try and get him on video. Okay, we have Saurabh's video. So, Saurabh, if you can hear us, you could continue with your case.
Yeah, I can hear you guys.
We can see you.
Hello. Yes, sir. Can start with your case.
Okay.
My name is Saurabh Modi, and this is my real name. I actually belong to Jaipur, Rajasthan. I currently live in Los Angeles. I'm an Indian citizen, and I've been residing in the U.S. for the last 4 years. I've been educated at Mayo College, Ajmer, IIT Delhi, and I'm Calcutta. And I come from a very good, a very respectable family from Jaipur. My wife, Shweta Lalwani, and my in-laws, Professor Sushil Jagdish Lalwani and Lalita Lalwani from Jodhpur, they first fooled me and they took my son, my two-month-old son, Saket.
Saurabh, if you can just be a little slow.
Okay, I'm
just
sorry.
Just a little slow.
Sure. So, I was just trying to wrap it up. As I just mentioned, my wife, Shweta Lalwani, and my in-laws, Sushil Jagdish Lalwani and Lalita Lalwani from Jodhpur, they first fooled me and they took my two-month-old son, Saket Modi, from U.S. to India in January 07. Ever since then, like for the last 12 months, they have denied me access to my son, who is actually a U.S. citizen. His Indian visa, his Indian tourist visa has also expired. It expired in June. He's staying there wrongly. And now they have made false dowry allegations, 498A, against me and my father and my mother, my parents in India, just to cover up, you know, whatever wrongs they are doing. And also by misusing this, you know, this 498A law, which is nothing but, you know, which is like a weapon of legal terrorism by the Indian government. And they are not just trying to extort money, they're asking for 25 lakh rupees, they're pressurizing me and my parents in India. Just to give everyone like a brief background on myself, as I already mentioned, I did my engineering from IIT Delhi and from IIM Calcutta. I got married after my MBA in December 2003, and immediately after my marriage I came to America, I came to the United States with my wife. We had a very good married life, we had an extremely loving marital relationship. I have a lot of documents, evidential support. I have provided all that to the police in my 498A case. I have more than 2,000 beautiful photographs with me and my wife, which everything clearly proves, you know, all the kind of love and the kind of care that I always had for my wife. When everything was fine in January 2006, which is exactly 2 years back, we were happy with a married life and we mutually decided to plan a baby. My wife got pregnant and our son was born on 12th November 2006. Law started all the problems. I mean, when the girl is pregnant, you know, she has all those hormonal balances and all those things. But what happened was, throughout the period of pregnancy and also after that, my in-laws, my father-in-law and mother-in-law who are in Jodhpur, and my sister-in-law who is in Chicago, my wife's sister who is in Chicago, they continuously interfered in my family life and my marital life, and they created unnecessary ego hassles, ego tussles between me and my wife. And the main reason why they disliked me was because their elder son-in-law, you know, who lives in Chicago, for the husband of their elder daughter, they actually, you know, I'm not as subdued as him, and I always told them if I found anything wrong. My mother-in-law came here for my wife's delivery, but before that, before doing anything, she went back to Chicago. So basically, you know, just to cut short the details, without sharing all the details, my wife actually said that she just wants to visit India, and then I arranged for all the paperwork, and she went there, and after reaching there, she made one excuse or the other to come back. She did not attend the visa interview. She stopped taking her phone calls, and I really don't know what to do. And a few months back, 3-4 months back, they also filed this false 498A. I have been continuously trying to get reunited with my wife. I obviously miss my wife. There was nothing wrong between me and my wife. I miss my son a lot. And, I mean, the only reason I got in touch with these good people from Save India Family is that, I mean, I don't know what else to do, because the police kind of harasses my parents. My father is a very senior government officer. He is a very honest person, but the police harasses them. I cannot do anything. I cannot go to India to see my son. I just don't know what to do, basically. And, I mean, I really don't know what I am. The only reason I'm sharing my correct name, my true name, is because I just need some help. I just need some kind of help from the journalists in India. If they can probably bring this to light, if they can bring this to light of, you know, big people and people who can make a difference in this case, so that my in-laws get some sense, so that my wife learns that I really love her so much and I really miss her and I want her and my son back in my life. If they want, I can come back to India. I can do whatever they want to do. But, you know, these kind of false cases...
So, this is a very common scenario. When we were discussing more cases, you would see that there was a normal decision which went towards this was a 498A. As far as child custody is concerned, the child is abducted to India and the biological parent goes to complete contact, which is not good for the child either. So, Anupa, we can go to the next case.
Yes, who's next, Andy?
Ram.
Okay, so let's just try and get his video. Can we get Ram?
Well, my video camera is not working, the webcam.
What's his ID?
So, his webcam is not working, so we can just listen to the audio, what he has to say.
Okay, fine.
Hi, this is Ram.
Hi,
Anupa, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Ram. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm a doctor. I'm very well settled. In fact, you know, even before my marriage here, I was already a full-fledged practicing medical consultant, a specialist. I was earning on average of $300,000 per year when I got married. Whilst I was here in the U.S., I met this U.S. citizen lady. We dated for some time. We lived together, and then we got married because she was pregnant. And, soon after that, her behavior started changing. Meanwhile, I'd learned that, you know, she'd been previously married to a low, middle-class American citizen who actually, apparently, it turned out, had a police record, and that she had obtained her citizenship through this person. She then divorced him after getting her citizenship. And, in fact, it appeared as if she'd used his police record against him for blackmail purposes. because when we got copies of the her previous divorce records, that gentleman didn't even come to the court to contest the divorce, which means this person is, you know, very conniving. Anyhow, after our marriage, my wife was abusive towards me, my family and friends. Nobody was welcome, and all she wanted was a good lifestyle. I was providing her with a living nanny, a housekeeper, a cleaning lady, you know, and whatever she wanted, she had it. And, you know, very few people in America can afford to do that. But, you know, this lady had a personality disorder, which actually was later on confirmed by the court-appointed psychologist. And then I discovered that she'd had numerous other failed relationships because she was always unfaithful in a relationship and because of her abusive behavior. So anyway, I thought maybe marriage counseling would help, so I took her for marriage counseling, but she didn't want to listen to what any of the psychologists had to say because she claimed that they were all my paid flunkies. You know, eventually in desperation and nothing failed, I tried talking to her family members, you know, I mean, you know, like it was really a dysfunctional, you know, family that I was dealing with. I eventually filed for divorce because of her abusive behavior. In fact, I even had a detective's video which showed my then-wife checking into a hotel with her boyfriend. And, like, you know, I tried talking to her but didn't stop her. And, you know, meanwhile, there were, you know, children involved. And after I filed for divorce, it took me almost 3 years to obtain a divorce. You know, the legal cost was in excess of $500,000. And then, you know, I mean, during this period, my then-wife took an additional $500,000. And eventually, I finally obtained a divorce. And, you know, I mean, she, after I filed for divorce, after some time, she tried to, you know, fabricate over here. And she wrote anonymous letters to my workplace and did all kinds of bad things. And eventually, it backfired on her because her lies were exposed before the U.S. courts. The psychologists and the custody evaluators, everybody understood what was going on and what she was trying to do. Then, you know, what she does is she turns around and claims that her father is dying in India and, you know, his last wish is to be allowed to see his grandchildren. So, on, you know, compassionate grounds, I said, okay, you know, I gave her, you know, permission for a two-week visit. And, you know, she never returned the children after that. You know, I was awarded sole custody. I took, you know, I mean, compassion here into account. And, you know, like, when I tried calling her up in India, you know, saying, you know, you were supposed to come back in 2 weeks, she said she doesn't care for U.S. laws anymore. Although she was a U.S. citizen, my children are U.S. citizens. They were born in the United States. You know, and she even threatened over the phone that her family owned their local police station, and they were, you know, her family were friends with certain high-level bureaucrats in India, like, you know, I mean, politicians, and they could get away with any crime in India, and they could even influence Supreme Court judges. And, you know, I mean, she even claimed that, you know, because of these connections, the family got away with all kinds of things, you know, for the last 25 years. And, you know, guess what? What she did next was, because I started pushing, saying, you know, I want my children back. Then she goes and files, you know, a dowry complaint. This is months after the U.S. divorce, claiming that her family had given us $12,000 over the life of the marriage. What would I do with $12,000 when I was earning $300,000 per year from even before the marriage? And then she, you know, wants the Indian courts to overturn the U.S. court custody orders and the divorce decree. And, you know, under the Hindu Marriage Act, you know, she wants a divorce, although we got married here in the U.S. And she wants the Indian courts to give her and her family, my family's assets that run into several crores. She wants, you know, I mean, 30 lakh rupees as a starter thing over there. Plus she wants $10,000 per month sitting in India, denying me access to my children because I can't visit India because of false dowry complaint that was filed several months after the U.S. divorce. And, you know, all this has been going on with the blessing of some Indian government officials. And, you know, to make matters worse, she was even allowed or helped by some officials to change my children's last names, surnames. And the cases have been dragged out in the Indian courts. She changes repeatedly. The lawyers, the judges keep changing. And it's gone on for years and years. So, you know, I'm at my wit's end trying to figure out what to do. My children have been denied access to me, you know, phone, email, letters. My ex-wife and her family, you know, not allowed my children to, you know, stay in touch with me. And this is despite the fact that I am the natural guardian who was actually awarded sole custody of my children by the U.S. courts that actually had the jurisdiction, because my children were born in the U.S., they've always lived here, right? But, you know, the Indian courts don't seem to care about that. You know, they ignore the fact that this is where the children lived, they were born, brought up here. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, what are they giving the natural guardian? You know, in the Indian Constitution talks about the father being the natural guardian. Here I'm the sole custodial parent, you know, and despite all that, I get nothing from the Indian, you know, political system, the Indian legal system, the bureaucrats. You know, I question, you know, the ladies and gentlemen who are present there, you know, with the journalists. You know, is there a parent amongst you who would be willing to undergo such an enforced separation from his children, not really feel upset? You know, how can you just sit quietly and not even raise these issues, you know? I mean, right. I'm just totally flabbergasted.
Thank you, Ram. So, as you can see, the anguish of fathers who get separated with their children, and how desperate they are with their children, but due to jurisdictional issues and due to the connivance of certain officials, to their children, which is their right. The similar story is that of Nirej. So, Nirej, if you are there, then we can set up the webcam for you and as well as the audio.
Andy, whose video do we have next? Is there someone else on video that we have?
Yeah, we have a couple of other people on video as well. So, Nirej, are you ready? Okay, yes, Nirej, you are part of the joy. So, we can...
Who do we have?
Let's go to Rana.
Rana,
yeah, is this webcam on? Yes, sir. Okay, hold on.
Can
we see you? Let me just close the window. Hold on a second. Okay, can you see my video now?
Who do we have, Andy?
We have Rana. The webcam is on.
No, my webcam is up. Hold on.
Okay, we're requesting permission from Rana for letting us view his webcam.
Sure. I think it was Andy.
Is there someone who's available right away?
We have Ramesh over here. So that is the last piece of the slide. So I guess we can put Ramesh on the camera.
Okay, I have one viewer here.
That would be me, I guess. Anyway, I'm putting Ramesh on the
camera. Okay, all right. Andy, on Andy's website. Ramesh on Andy's website. Just let us see you. Okay.
Yeah,
all right, Ramesh, we can see you.
Okay. Yeah, I was married for 5 years, and actually my wife had a mental ailment prior to the marriage, which was not even close to me. She had some obsessive compulsive disorder with a paranoid syndrome. Anyways, I eventually helped her get over that and started a family. And what eventually happened was in October 2006, she said her father had to get a heart surgery, a heart bypass surgery, and I stepped along with her, and she was expected to return within 2 weeks. Initially, she postponed that by 1 week. And then, in that week, on November 8th, she filed for child custody in India. But she continued to talk to me till November 10th, as though nothing had happened. And on November 10th, I got to know that she got ex parte order of child custody from the Indian courts. My son resided in the U.S. His ordinary residence was in the U.S. The Guardian and Watch Act, the Indian Act, says the jurisdiction belongs to the court where the child ordinarily resides. But the court has jurisdiction. And I contest the case in India for almost 5 months. In the first 5 months of the court case in India, there was absolutely no mention of any penalty or any threatening talk from me or my family. On March 2015, I got a court order from the Bangalore court which directed my wife to ensure that the child has constant contact with me. Within a matter of 5 hours, an FIR was lodged. My 80-year-old father was arrested. He was dragged away to the jail, along with my sister, who was the acquired fracture. Our two kids, one 3-year-old and another 9-year-old, had no clue where their mother was, 2 whole days. And I've not been able to talk to my son for almost 1 year. And once when I tried to contact on June 8th, my son heard my voice and he came out running, calling to me, pop, 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 pop. He was dragged away from the room. And even from the other room, he was calling out to me. I brought this to the notice of the court repeatedly. I even filed contempt of court. All that the court does is give additional days, and it has not done anything to address my situation. I have a U.S. court order granting me sole custody. My parents are very well respected. They are in the academic field. I'm still surprised that, people can transform civil case into criminal case with just a snap of a finger.
Ramesh, there's a bit of an echo when you're talking.
Hello?
Ramesh? Yes? There's a bit of an echo when you're talking. Can you just fix that? Is there a way to fix that?
Actually, I was almost done.
Okay, all right, fine.
Rana now.
Okay, Rana?
Yeah.
Rana, we can see you.
Okay.
Shall I start?
Okay, sir. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. My name is Rana Ray, and this is my real name. And since I have nothing to hide, and I really want this, like Saurav wanted, to come out in public so that people know about it. That's why I'm using my real name and my ex-wife's and my daughter's name. Basically, in my case, it's a little bit strange because my ex-wife and I, we almost grew up together. We were like childhood friends. And we got married in 96, and we came here immediately after. And we've been living here since then. And everything was going fine, and, we have a daughter, Nalanda, in 2000. And Nandini's parents, my ex-in-laws, they visited us, when Nalanda was born. And they were here for a few months. Everything was going fine and nicely. Something happened in 2004. Before that, let me just tell you one other thing. Nandini tried to pursue in a lot of careers here. I put her in computer classes. I put her, in the college here just to get, whatever she wants to do because she didn't want to sit home. But nothing really worked out for her. Her H-1 got rejected and stuff like that. And finally in 2000, we got her green card. And she said, and since Nalanda was born by then, she said, well, I'm going to pursue my dance career. So the home that we bought, I just made the basement a dance studio where she can practice and, she can have her own business running. And in the meantime, I used to take care of Nalanda, my daughter. I remember I used to go to work, pretty much I could go any time. I used to go at around 4:30 in the morning so that I can come back by 4 in the evening so that she can, she can carry on with, her dance troupe and everything when I'm going to take care of Nalanda. So
I was enjoying you know, my fatherhood, and I was really enjoying with my daughter. It was a great pleasure seeing her growing up. And things were working perfectly for us. In fact, in almost whole of New Jersey knew us as the perfect pair, perfect couple. Something started going wrong in late 2003, which I didn't really realize. You know, I just figured out that she spent more time outside because of her dance commitments, this and that. And in 2004, like, this is a big shocker. One fine morning, she just told me that she wants out. And I begged, and I did this, and I did that, because I was totally confused. I had no idea what was going on. And finally, I agreed to pretty much whatever she said in the divorce, because I know it sounds extremely foolish, and I'm ashamed to say that I completely trusted her during the divorce process. And because she said that once the divorce is over, you know, everything's going to be fine. We're just not going to be married, but everything's going to be okay. I trusted her, so, you know, I pretty much gave her physical custody, and I just have visitation. And then I realized that the whole divorce happened because she had an affair with her best friend's husband. And the person who came and told me that was my little four-year-old daughter, who had been seeing this guy coming into her new apartment every day and staying there. This is actually during the divorce proceedings where we were separated. After that, you know, I came to know about this whole thing. I was shocked, betrayed, but, you know, I couldn't really do much. 2006 is when these two finally got married in India. And I came to know from some of my common friends in India. In the meantime, I was also in touch with, you know, this guy's ex-wife, who happened to be, you know, our common friend also, because we were like family friends. This whole fiasco. In 2006, after they got married and they visited India and they came back, I spoke to Nandini and I said, you know, it's time to change the custody order a little bit, because now I really want joint physical and legal, and because I have to save my daughter. And, you know, also the visitation schedule and everything needs to be changed. And she was just sitting on that, and finally I sent her a lawyer's letter saying, you know, this has to be done now. And it's best to be done out of court so that we can do it, you know, in a civil way, without, like, fighting with each other. She received the letter, and she pretended as if she's going to agree to everything. And after 2 weeks, all of a sudden, I received a letter from her lawyer, I mean my lawyer received it, saying she's relocating to India because her father is sick. And we received that letter on Friday after the court was closed, so we couldn't really do much. She met me on Saturday, and she said that, you know, if you just sign a blank paper saying you don't want anything, then I'll agree. I didn't agree to that, and she fled. That was in 2006. So I went to court, and I filed a motion for improper removal of child. And it got dragged on for a year, and finally, you know, a few days back, I got sole custody. And, you know, she has, I gave her 30 days to redeem, basically 30 days to come back to U.S. to avoid, I'm not sure what she's going to do. Last time I spoke to Nalanda was May the 2nd. That is just before the U.S. court was issuing an order to send Nalanda back. And she came to know through her lawyer, and that's exactly when she cut down all communication. I mean, to be very honest with you, I have never seen evil before. This is the first time in my life that I'm seeing an evil person. And a person who I knew has completely turned to be something that I never wanted to see. And to make the thing even worse, her current husband ran away 3 months ago, leaving his two kids at the airport. I mean, I know it's shocking, but he's another person. He's also a father. he took his children out for dinner, and that's what he told his ex-wife. He left them stranded at the airport, and he called his ex-wife when he was boarding the flight, saying, his children are, by the way, 12 and 8 years old. He called his ex-wife and said, you know, I'm just boarding the plane. I'm going to India forever. The children are at the airport, so, you know, if you want, come pick them up. He lost his house here. His house is in foreclosure. He's on the run. He's been questioned by FBI. And he's like a criminal, because once he physically attacked me, and I have a pending suit against for domestic violence in U.S. So all I'm trying to say is, this is my situation. I don't know whether my ex is going to file 498 or whatever, because the entire marriage thing is, you know, my family, not my family, basically I took up the whole bill. For a visa, for an air ticket, for everything, for my reception, for her reception. So, and also after that, I had a bank account with her father. I pretty much, you know, I mean, they pretty much left in our money back then. So I think, yeah, unless she's really shameful, I mean, she's really probably not filed for 498, and also the fact that she's married and she's claiming that she's having another baby with this guy. She may not file for anything, but there's a constant threat. This person calls up my mother and threats her. My mother is a 60-year-old lady. And now they have successfully brainwashed Nalanda. Now when Nalanda speaks to me, she cries and she says, Daddy, I don't want to talk to you. So that is my situation. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know how to react. But one thing I can tell you that, you know, I'll see to the end. I mean, if she doesn't come back, she has an arrest warrant against her. I don't know how to implement that in India. But I will get my daughter back. I'll have to get my daughter back. So
we wish you all the best, Rana. So as you can see, the parental alienation syndrome, wherein a child is abducted to India, and the child is turned again the parent from whom it has been abducted. We also have some slides that Arupma can show, showing the rich interaction that the father has with their children. Arupma, if you could go over the slides and then take over from here.
Sure. Andy, we don't have anybody else. Is there anybody else who'd like to share a story with us?
These are the planned ones. So is there anybody else who wants to come out with this story?
I think many others couldn't join because it's rather late out here.
I think so, yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, like 2 in the morning, 2:30 in the morning for some. And everybody has to go into work the following morning.
Yeah, actually, one of the person was supposed to join, but she kind of dropped out because it was late. Is Tilottama?
That's all right.
So it's a pretty odd over here.
Can I join, Andy? Can I?
Who's that?
Yes, Anand, please go ahead.
This is Anand.
Anand, we do have one more case of Mr. Anand Rao.
And,
okay.
Anand,
you can
break
the story.
Does he have a
webcam,
Andy?
Hello?
Anand, do you have a
webcam
on?
Oh, okay. This is Anand in California.
Okay.
And
all right, Anand.
Hello. I married my wife from Kanpur, India, and it was about 6-7 years back. And it was all in good faith that we advertised in the newspaper that and looking for the advertisement and then selecting the photos and then finally got engaged and married. But up until now, after the marriage, we came to know suddenly that this was a proposal which I had and my family had rejected more than 10 years before and didn't want to go and connect with family because we had found the problem in the family. But over the 10 years, neither she got married and I was in U.S. I couldn't get married. I mean, I was also not married. But we had all forgotten about this. They remember somehow that we are, I am the same person who had earlier rejected them but never told us because we all forgot. And later they told after the marriage this was happened. Soon after the marriage, my wife went to her parents' place and immediately within a week we came to United States. As soon as she came with me to United States, very first night she started demanding the money, telling me that in her family it is a custom that their son-in-law always gives the money to her parents or to my father-in-law or parents-in-law. This is the custom. I was very shocked. This is the, just within a week of the marriage and very first night in the United States when he came here. I told her that, you know, when there is money, I will certainly help in emergency, but on a regular basis, you know, I have my own expenses, our own family here, and if there is a need, I can surely do, but not on a regular basis, it is not appropriate. She started showing the symptoms that how a mental sick person, when I has this mental manic depressive syndrome, bipolar syndrome, how they behave and they keep hiding it. Became very aggressive, violent, and started beating me, became very violent. I was very afraid. I was in the university student also and did not know what to do. One night she fabricates that I have stripped her of all the clothes in the winter and made her nude and thrown her out of the house, beaten or something, and then runs away from the house. Knowing that maybe she would not get the U.S. Citizenship. And in this situation, she ends up suddenly in a woman's house asking for the U.S. citizenship in some context, but she could never get. So the idea was that she wanted to use me to come to the United States to get the U.S. citizenship or green card, and her parents will always keep asking her all the time whether you got the citizenship or not, all the time since after the marriage, and we came here within a week of the marriage. They never talked to me, ever, ever. Till now, they have never talked to me. Only concern and their need was to find out if their daughter has got the green card or not. When she became pregnant, I wanted to let her go to India and be with either her mother or my parents or in the hospital wherever medical care can be given. But her parents put the foot down in India, telling my parents that they married my daughter only for the sake of United States, and we in the United States, they will never let her come and have the baby in India. She has to have the baby in India and she will remain there. She will not come. So when the baby was born, she put the foot down that my father's name cannot be put on the certificate because she only wanted her name so that the father doesn't have any claim on the certificate. Big query in the hospital until the higher authorities intervene. So I'm trying to relate here the story that the person solely married with all the deception in mind that a person is being used as a vehicle in the mood to go to the United States, get the U.S. citizenship and green card, and find whatever or fabricate whatever story they can, take the advantage of the law of the land or the loopholes of the law here in the United States, fabricate the story, put the allegations and run away. She ran away with two children. I have two children, then two little children, one daughter and one son, ran away again from the house with children. Went and ended up in the women's shelter again and asking that she should be given the green card because husband is not giving her green card or husband is wanting. But police has no evidence, never ever found any problem with on my side, in fact on her side. And she, after several months of staying out of the house with children in the women's shelter, somehow she returned back. Again demanding that I should let her get some of citizenship or go to India. The immigration office told her that she cannot get the citizenship on the basis of children. So she started demanding that she should be allowed to go to India, give her money, and her parents started threatening that if I don't do that, they will do this 498A. 498 was dangling on me like a sword. I cannot breathe, I cannot live, I can understand the ramifications of the 498, how dangerous it is, that it is so blanket and blind that without even investigation, it arrests everybody and then creates the turmoil in everybody's life on the opposite side, on the husband's side. It is so gender biased. Finally, one day, you know, she fabricated and ran away with children again. Too many times she ran away from the house, it became the problem for me. I asked her to change her visa because it was ending. She wouldn't want to change the visa because if she will change the visa, she will have to stay here and she cannot have the children. So she let her visa expire and then decided to go to India. She took the money from me. She wanted to go to India. And in all good faith, she took all the documents and passports to go to India on the pretext that she will come back here in a month. It has been since August. She ran away. She has not even allowed me to talk to. When I tried to contact her mother, father, and everybody, gave me threat on the phone that if ever I try to call and talk to her or about my children, they will hire some gundas from Kanpur and they will get my brother and parents killed there in India. So I should never contact them. And they have never allowed me till date to contact my children or her. It is her parents who are threatening me, giving me threats, and shielding her from letting me contact or children to contact me. And that's what is happening. So I'm trying to mention here this 498A law and the false fabrication of the stories of the incidences by the women or the wives taking loopholes in the U.S. laws or the Indian laws. They are creating such harassment to the husband that there is no rescue, no protection for the husband. What should husbands do in this situation?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Rao. Andy, what do we want to do now? Do you want to have the question and answer session now?
I think there are still a few more slides in the presentation. We could go ahead with it. But before we go there, I also want to mention that we do have a case studies document over there, and the cases that have been discussed today, those cases
Andy,
are...
Andy, at your end, there's an echo. It's not audible to him.
Oh, I see. Okay. Is it better now?
Hello?
Yes, that's better. Go ahead.
Okay, so I just wanted to mention that all these cases that have been discussed today are available in a case study document that we have, and you can get the particular more details about the cases that are being discussed today in that document. So, I look forward to you.
Naveen was supposed to join us on the video conference, but unfortunately he could not. We have Naveen's parents as well as his brother here, and they would like to just present his case briefly. So, if you go ahead.
Speaking right now. quite helpful.
So there's somebody from the US, I think, who's joining in. So we could just session on this. After this, you could speak to the journalist directly. I think it's 3 a.m. there or something they want to. Is there any queries at all that you would like to ask these MRI men? Then
yes,
you could do it right now. But
yes,
any
I have a few questions. Rana here,
sorry? Say that again.
Rana here.
Yeah, Daniel?
Yeah, I had a few questions, actually.
Okay.
This is just about the press conference. I mean, what is the next step? I mean, where are we going to take this from here?
Who is this?
Rana.
Just hang in there, and you'll get to know where we are going. So I think we have presented most of the case studies, and the pattern has been established. When the child custody battle is lost by the women in the U.S., they flee to India with the children, and then the relationship between the child and the father is permanently cut out. So the effect of that would be mentioned by Anupma in the coming slides, and then we'll have a Q&A session about child custody cases. All right?
Okay.
Andy, are you ready to take questions?
Have you finished the two slides regarding the effect of fatherlessness?
Do you want me to complete the presentation first?
Yeah, just complete the presentation, Anupma.
I think complete the presentation and then we'll have the question.
So, that's the question. So as you can see, most of these, in fact, all of these NRI men are actually loving and responsible fathers and husbands who have been caught in criminal cases. And there are problems with the marriages, which are due to very certain reasons. In Rana's case, there was an extramarital affair. Wife just decided to leave him, but also decided to leave along with the child. There are many, many issues, but as we're trying to highlight, most of the time, none of these issues involve dowry. As you can see in all these cases, they're all well-to-do and successful men who have absolutely no reason to ask for a small sum like $10,000 or $12,000. However, they have all been accused of having done so, usually in order to either get custody or for various different reasons. Now, just very briefly, we have some photographs from some of these cases that I'd like to share with you. And then very quickly, some few points that we'd like to raise as to this entire issue of misuse of these laws. Now, here's Saurabh. You heard a story earlier with his daughter. We have Lorraine with his children, as per the same, 9-year-old and 6-year-old children, medical children. And again, he's lost all contact with his children. Ramesh Krishnan there, whom you saw earlier, who broke down during his story with his child, who he's not been able to speak with for the last 1 year or see. So basically what we're trying to say, when all this happens and there are two adults who are feuding, who are the people who lose out the most? Well, the people who lose out are our children. And there does not seem to be any point of reference to these very children. The courts seem to ignore it. There is absolutely no forum addresses this very, very pertinent issue. The child who actually ends up with a fractured childhood. It is important for the child to have both his parents. I'm not saying that it's just the father, it's the mother as well as the father. And is this what we want the future of our children to be? Kids from fatherless homes. Well, studies, and these are studies with great published data which tell you that kids from fatherless homes are 5 times more likely to commit suicide, they're 32 times more likely to run away or to have behavioral disorders, they're 14 times more likely to commit rape, 9 times more likely to drop out of high school, to use chemical substances, go into state-operated institutions, and in prison. Teenage pregnancy, again, daughters of single parents who are 53% more likely to marry as teenagers and to have premarital birth and more likely to dissolve their own marriages as well. Child abuse, 60% of documented child abuse perpetrators are women with sole custody of their children. So these were studies. I mean, this is not mere hearsay. These are studies which have documented that this is the outcome of full custody. Shared parenting reduces isolation and introduces the needed checks and balances. And 75% of children who live in single parent homes experience poverty before they turn 11. Only 20% of those in two family homes wait. Obviously, there have been various studies on this subject. There's conflict of jurisdiction in which Indra Jaisingh herself said that the problem of divorce in child custody cases is complicated, especially when the two battling parents are in different countries. In such situations, visitation by the other parent becomes nothing but a legal formality on paper, with no practical possibilities. There's the tendency of one parent turning the child against the other or the parental alienation syndrome. Jaisingh stressed that today it is important that India signs the Hague Convention, especially due to the problem raised on recognizing and respecting foreign judgments on the issue. Now, what we would like to question the government, and this is like through the media, you know, to raise our question as to why is India not a signatory to the Hague Convention still, and why are there proposals to be a signatory to the Hague Convention, but very, very selectively, as in they would like to sign only the things that they would like. They would like the U.S. court to recognize Indian court orders, but they are not willing to extend the same courtesy to the U.S. court, as in what they want is that the U.S. court orders would not be recognized in India, which is completely not acceptable in any court of law. Again, there is other Justice Lakshmanan from the Judge of the Supreme Court who said the same thing. The practice of international child abduction has its roots in interference in custody battles. And the convention secures, the Hague Convention secures the prompt return of children who are wrongfully removed or detained in any contracting state and ensures the rights of custody and access for both parents. Vita Sharma, who reported that more and more separated NRI couples are taking advantage of India's ability to resolve inter-country disputes, inability to resolve inter-country disputes over child custody, and that India is becoming a safe haven for child abductors. And Supreme Court in a matter heard in 1994 rightly said, it does not buy the argument that only mothers can take care of young children. The notion of family has changed dramatically, and many men are better at taking care of children than women. In 2007, as per UNICEF's Progress for Children report, released in December 2000, India continues to be among the worst performers in the world in terms of ensuring that children have the basic rights. Much like the public outcry that ensued following the discovery of children's remains in Nepal, a similar alacrity is needed to ensure that India's children get their due. I'm really going to skip this. We'll go back to the U.S. Department of Justice report, which says that India is the safe haven for international child abduction. The court system in India is extremely slow so that the abductor has ample time to create facts on the ground in terms of getting the child sufficiently settled into life in India, and thereon to justify an Indian court in ultimately deeming that it is best to keep the child in India. Courts outside India should be extremely wary about allowing parents to take children for temporary visits to India over the objections of the other parents, since there is a great likelihood that parents who wrongfully retain children in India will get away with their wrongful conduct scot-free in India.
Anupma?
Yes.
This is Satya. Can I just make a request to our journalist friends over there?
Yes, go ahead, Satya.
Okay. This is my actually prayer to all the journalists who are attending and listening to this press conference. One of the reasons we have organized this press conference today before the Pravasi Bharati Divas is to basically request you to raise these very pertinent and important questions to the minister, the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs in the upcoming Pravasi
Vyasi Bharati Divas that is going to be held at Delhi between 7th and 9th of January, where the government is going to, you know, request NRIs to invest and, you know, basically praise whatever they have done for India, for name, fame and money. And we, as our organization of all the people, all the NRIs who have been going through this problem, we have exhausted ourselves. We have written numerous letters, memorandums to the ministry. We have personally met to the secretary Nirmal Singh. We have personally met with several times met with the minister Vela Ravi. We have met with the director Satya Shukla. We have several times talked with the ministry officials and requested them for help, and we have not heard any assurances of anything that is going to help us out in any near future. So we would request our esteemed journalist over there to actually contact and raise these questions about how NRIs are becoming so vulnerable that any false allegations against them can actually ruin their future, their livelihood in a foreign country, the whole extended family, and they are extorted for huge, huge sums of money.
Right. So basically what Sachin, I think, is trying to say is while you hear a lot of what being said in the media about how you know, women are being conned by NRI men and how they're being ill-treated, etc., etc. You hear an increasing number of dowry cases. Basically, here we've shown you a large number of NRI men who, in fact, have been conned by their wives, and their children have been wrongfully removed from a country to India. They had no jurisdiction to bring their children here. But there is no forum in India where these men can actually go and lodge a complaint. And the courts certainly are too slow to respond, and the response is also inadequate. What he's trying to say is there has been concerted efforts by the NRIs to go to the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs, which is supposed to be the bridge between NRI men and supposed to look into their problems. There have been various opportunities where they've tried to go to the Ministry of External Affairs, the Ministry of Home Affairs, and basically found out that there's absolutely no forum where a man can go ahead and lodge his complaint. So why is it that the same, you know, is not extended to men, and there should be a forum where they can be audited there? Now, just one case that I'd like to highlight, recently, despite the fact that India's not a signatory to the Hague Convention, U.S. just sent back to India a child who was kidnapped from indoors by the mother in Ajay Garg versus Deepa Garg. As per the U.S. court, and in fact, as per any court, you know, anywhere in the world, the best interest of what is to be. And many times it's been found that in India, that has been sort of ignored when looking at child custody issues. And Indian courts do not apply the same principle. I'm just going to, you know, these questions, these certain questions that Sachin was referring to, very quickly, we just like to talk about these issues and what we would like the media to raise these issues for us. And that is, can the best interest of the kidnapped non-Indian citizen or non-registered child who is born to a non-Indian citizen be best decided based on local Indian parameters in an Indian court by ignoring all evidence, testimony, jurisdiction that may have been presented in the foreign court where the child resided prior to the abduction? Would this be in the best interest of the kidnapped child? More often than not, the abducting parents delay Indian court proceedings for many years, and in fact they do not need to delay the proceedings because you know, the legal machinery in India ensures that every case is delayed by more than years. Would it be appropriate to reward the errant parent or the kidnapper with interim custody until the matter is adjudicated in regular custody proceedings, which last 6 to 8 years in the custody court in India? And had the child not been abducted from a foreign country, where would the child ordinarily reside? And as you saw, all these fathers had
sole custody, which was awarded to them by the court in the US, and that is when the mother decided to jump jurisdiction and flee to India. Now, our appeal basically is that our children are our only hope for the future, that we are their only hope for their present and their future. We do need to strengthen current custody laws. We need to treat issues with urgency and resolve with expeditiously, prevent abuse and maintain contact. And children often would see that they are used with forms in life and disputes. Now, if it is using adults, there's really no reason why the child should be made to suffer. And the child's best interest must always be addressed as quickly as possible. Separate custody issues from all other matters. If there's a dowry issue or if there's any other issue, let it be thought on its own merits separately. But the child must not suffer through all this. Because as soon as the wife turns a civil custody case into a criminal formality case, the father and his family completely loses contact with the child. This proceeding to custody matters over other matters and fast-tracked to a maximum of 6 months to resolution. Apply common sense principles to define jurisdiction. If you have people, as if they were in state, who've been living in the United States for 14 years, the children are 9 and 6, they are United States citizens. How is it that their custody cases suddenly jump jurisdiction to India and where there is absolutely no evidence? And how are Indian courts supposed to handle this and decide this issue? Prevent abuse and maintain contact with the child. So fathers must be taught to ensure that the child can maintain contact with his left behind parents and grandparents. And not just pass these orders on paper and really not enforce them. We would like to see that these orders are enforced, that there should be some kind of a deterrence to the person who does not comply with the court orders. Prevent abuse by assigning licensed child psychologists and counselors to case and order bi-weekly welfare visits and mandatory child counseling. Safeguard the child's rights. There should be a special independent commission which investigates violation of children's rights under UNCRC in cases of all parental child abduction. I mean, as of now, in India, you cannot, an NRI man cannot even lodge a complaint about child abduction. So, where does he go with this complaint? Make parental abduction in crime. And like I said, in India, parental abduction is not seen as a crime, which is what makes it such a safe haven for all abductors. It's a heinous crime, it's tantamount to child abuse of the worst kind. Better abductions by treating it as a cognizable, non-bailable, and non-compatible crime. Sign the Hague Convention. Now, India wants that all court orders from India should be recognized in the US. It's very important that if you want that, it should also be vice versa, and you should be a signatory to the Hague Convention. So, that is important. It's important to promptly return the child victim wrongfully removed despite the training of others, despite the fact that they're citizens of another country and they are killed most often of tourist visas that have expired many, many months or years ago. And ensure that rights of custody and of access under the law of NRI's country are respected in India as well.
That is pretty much it. So if the esteemed generalist has any questions for regarding any of the cases or regarding any of the stuff that we have discussed, we'll be happy to answer.
Are there any questions that you would like to pose to any of these men whose cases you've just heard? If there are any queries, then we could take them up. Or we'd like to bring on Christy Rainier now. Yes, go ahead, please. Give me a second.
Andy, is Rana with us? Yes, yes. Rana, this question is for you. Okay, go ahead. I'll repeat the question if you... I cannot hear clearly. Can you please speak up?
Just
Rana,
No, I cannot. I'm sorry, I cannot hear the question. Can
yeah, you can you please repeat the question loudly?
No, the U.S. court has already given him a structured deportation, which she's not complying with. Rana, Rana, the question is from Akansha from UNI, and what she wants to know is that since you'd already been granted visitation, and your wife was not complying with the visitation, then did you raise that issue with any court of law?
Yes, I did, actually. I did, because when I went to the CS court, I mean, you know, when we initially filed for wrongful removal of child, I did raise that question. First of all, I did not have any idea where they were, because all I had is just a cell phone. And they categorically told me just to call the cell phone, just so that I don't know where they are. And that leads to the whole thing, because initially, remember, the U.S. court, because my ex-wife brought in the divorce case, and the U.S. court actually granted her legal and physical custody, initially in 2005. And then they reversed the order, and they finally gave me sole custody, sole physical and legal custody, when my ex-wife denied to send my child back for at least a month visitation. We asked for 4 visitations. The U.S. court actually asked my ex to send my daughter for 4 visitations. And every one was denied. In fact, a couple of times, I bought the airline ticket for her and my father as a chaperone. And she simply said that no, she cannot do it now. And then finally, in May 2007, when the court said that, okay, my daughter has to come back in this particular flight at this particular time, and she'll be in US on this day, and she will live on that day. That's the time my ex-wife actually went to the Indian court and got a temporary injunction.
Rana, the understanding then is that your wife is in India.
Yeah.
She is.
Yes.
So that's exactly the point that we're trying to get across, is that they need, with their children, run to India, file false 498As against the husband in the US or in whichever country he is, to deter him from coming to India in order to fight for custody.
That's correct.
Anubma, the other thing that they do is the Indian courts also grant them an injunction preventing the father from, trying to retrieve his child from India.
That's right. That's what I mean, my case.
Right.
And the Indian courts do it despite U.S. court orders. Despite the existence of U.S. court orders, the Indian courts still issue injunctions saying the child can't be removed from India.
The Indian courts do not hear the husband's side when they actually decide to grant this temporary injunction to the wife.
Right, it's
so
always done ex parte.
That's what I'm saying, it's ex parte, they have no jurisdiction. See, the wife and the children have been residents of some other country. So they have no evidence, they have no jurisdiction, and they do not even hear the other side's story, and they grant the injunction.
Precisely.
So that's exactly what we try to point out. So what these gender bias laws have become is they've become a very, very powerful tool in the hands of some very unscrupulous women who can use it for several things. You know, they can use it in order to wrest custody from their husbands. They can use it in order to make money, extort. They can use it in order to facilitate a quick and a very favorable divorce. So there are so many different reasons as to why they would use it. But what we're trying to say, all that is facilitated by the law itself having so many loopholes.
Right, and the problem some is, of these women are doing it after they've lost custody in the United States. They've already got a divorce, and then they run to India because they want to relitigate everything and relitigate even the custody using Indian laws.
Absolutely. We saw in Ram's case, you know, he had already given her $500,000, you know, dollars already during the divorce proceedings. During the entire divorce proceedings, there was not a mention of dowry. After the divorce has been granted, she's taken the money, she runs to India, and now files a 498A against him, claiming that he took $12,000 in dowry. You know, after he's already given you $500,000, what is this claim if it's not spurious? And not only that, he had already been granted custody, sole custody of both the children. So she was allowed to file
a false dowry complaint after the divorce in the U.S. Just imagine.
That's right. So we're just trying to point out how the laws are completely misused, you know, and there may be a few women, possibly a very small number of cases that may actually be using these laws, but more often than not, the law is completely abused in the hands of very unscrupulous women.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, in my case and in some other cases also, these wives are the ones who brought in the divorce case. I mean, you know, they bring the divorce case in the U.S. because they probably know it's easy to get it. They get it. In my case, I paid her over $175,000. And she was happy with that. She was happy with that. She was happy with the custody because she had, you know, physical and legal custody. And when she went to India, she showed these papers. She showed this paper to enroll my daughter. And then when the next paper, and also, it's interesting that she was fighting the case here, and she constantly wrote the judge here personal letters saying that she is a U.S. citizen and she will absolutely go by the U.S. laws and nothing else. And at the same time, she goes to an Indian court and claims her to be an Indian citizen. And the court accepts that.
And I mean, in my case, my ex didn't even tell the Indian courts that she was already divorced in the U.S. And she tried to managed to get all these orders from India, from the Indian courts.
And in your case, you were married here.
Right.
Not even in India.
Married here, divorced here. We're all U.S. citizens. My children are U.S. citizens. I'm a U.S. citizen. My ex-wife is a U.S. citizen. And we're still now fighting cases in India.
Right.
And also, when they talk about the Hindu Marriage Act, in my case, in the Hindu Marriage Act, as far as I understand, if the child is over 6 years old and the mother is remarried after divorce, the custody comes to the father. That's what the
Well, there have been some recent judgments from the Supreme Court that
What I'm trying to say, Anupama, is, you know, it's just based on convenience, you know,
But, I mean, why are we discussing, jurisdiction or, you know, custody when custody has already been granted to us in the United States after a prolonged divorce litigation where there were custody evaluators, psychologists involved, and, you know, the judge also saw all the evidence here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
After that, the child gives a father custody. It's not a routine thing. It's only if the woman has done bad things, that's when the judge will grant the father custody.
That's right.
Now, these women run to India so that then they can hide all the bad things that they did in the United States because the Indian courts don't even look at the evidence.
That's right. No, there's no quarrel about what you're saying. That's completely true because as an Indian court, that's true of courts everywhere in the world where usually custody would be granted to the mother. Mm-hmm. So there have to be very, very strong reasons as to why the father would be given sole custody of the children. So either she's found maybe mentally unfit or there are some reasons for granting.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a whole lynch. Actually, there are 9 things, you know, for which the U.S. courts, you know, intend to penalized by ex-wife as when she's returned, and one of them just happens to be, you know, the abduction, but there are several other things, bad things that she's done. And, you know, to me, it's divorce, we're divorced, it's done and over with. Why am I going to go into all the bad things? The only thing that hurts me now is, you know, my children, that I can't have access to them thanks to her, thanks to her family's political and legal connections in India, and thanks to the legal system.
Right. I think the point has been well made that the jumping of jurisdiction happens to escape the U.S. Custody orders or any unfavorable orders and go to India and take advantage of the school litigation. So, Anupam, any more questions?
Absolutely, Andy. Are we going to introduce Christy Daniels now?
Yes, unless there are some other questions. If not, then I can introduce Christy.
I think so. Are there any queries at all? Yes, Andy, there's one more question. Yes. Yes, excellent question. Andy, what is being asked is Mr. Jandiani, am I correct? Mr. Jandiani wants to know that when you spoke to YLR Ravi, what did the minister have to say about this?
So, let me direct you to the person who spoke to him personally, and Satya, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I spoke to him personally too. You want me to tell them first what he said to me?
Sure.
Okay, I went and met with Mr. Valur Ravi at, this hotel he was staying at in Manhattan, New York. And, after showing him all the evidence, all the U.S. court orders and the findings against my ex-wife, initially he tried to tell me that, oh, it's not possible, the Indian courts are not that stupid that they would allow a U.S. citizen to run to India and file all these cases in India. So then his own secretary said to him, no, sir, actually in India anything is possible. This is this gentleman who happens to be his own deputy secretary telling him something like this. And then the gentleman says to me, this is, Shri Vailavar Ravi, oh, you have to take the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, go to the FBI, go to make sure Interpol lists your ex-wife because she's a U.S. citizen, she kidnapped your children. Don't stop. Go all the way. Because I told him, the cases are being dragged out in the lower court and the high court. He says, okay, go to the Supreme Court. So this is the only piece of advice he had for me. So then I wrote to him saying, sir, okay, I went to Interpol. She's listed on Interpol. What do I do next? He says, oh, well, go to the Supreme Court. And that is the end of it.
So one standard answer that we get is that since the matter is submitted to the court between the process of law and it is proposed and wait for the process of law to finish and then, the submit an article here.
So, this is Satya. I met Mr. Vailavar Ravi.
One second. Sachin, just one second. Basically, what he said was that the only thing Mr. Vailavar Ravi had to say was go to the Supreme Court. Yeah. He said that basically that's all the advice that he had. But
the problem, Anupama, is you cannot go directly to the Supreme Court. You'll have to go to the lower court, then the high court, then the Supreme Court.
Yes.
So it takes years for all these litigations.
No, he wants to know how long have you been in the process of litigation for China?
Me, 5 years.
5 years
India.
In the Indian court?
5 years in the Indian
five
court.
5 years in India.
And during this process, my ex-wife has changed about 8 different lawyers in India.
No. Where in India is your case?
New Delhi.
New Delhi. High court or lower court, where?
Both.
So he went to lower court and from there on had to go to high court as well.
Yeah, and then if my ex-wife loses something in one court, she just goes back to the other court. So it's back and forth.
Right. So how long were you in family court and then how long in high court?
No, it's still not over in the family court. The family court doesn't even want to make a decision. Because like I said, she keeps changing lawyers. No, right.
So how did she go to high court?
Well, because she managed to obtain an interim order, disallowing me to remove the children from India and all that kind of stuff. So now, then we challenged that in the High Court. And even that process has gone on for the last 3 years. And we haven't gotten anywhere because generally there are no hearings. Every time the judge changes or she changes lawyers and her new lawyers ask for more dates because they need to prepare the case.
Raj, can you also give them an estimate how much money you have already spent?
One second.
Yes. how long did it take you to get custody in the U.S. courts?
No, in the U.S. courts, the case was again dragged for 3 years. It took me 3 years to get, I filed for divorce in 98 and 2000, at the end of 2001 is when the whole thing was complete, the divorce trial and everything.
Okay, so you
can you give them an estimate how much money you spent in the U.S. court to get the
US, if you can translate into rupees?
In
the U.S. courts, I spent over $500,000 in legal fees because, again, over here, my ex-wife dragged the hearings out over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she changed seven different lawyers in the U.S. So it shows, you know, like, as to what we're dealing with. A person who's changed seven lawyers in the U.S. and eight lawyers in India, you know, how is this case ever going to end? And that obviously shows that if so much money has been spent, and then for India to allow to file a false dowry case claiming that a family gave us $12,000 over the life of the marriage, not even at the time of marriage, over the life of the marriage.
Can you please convert these monies, this million and thousands, into rupees just so that they have a good idea, a fair idea?
Half a million dollars
is about 2 crore rupees.
Yes, that's right. That's about 2 crore rupees.
Since I filed for divorce in 98, you know, like, I spent, about 5 crores. You know, like, what my ex-wife took and what, and then despite all that, she's allowed to go and file a false dowry complaint claiming that her family gave us 5 lakh rupees over the life of the marriage.
Just allow me to reiterate what you just said. 3 years in the U.S. court. $500,000, about 2 crore rupees. She changed seven lawyers in the U.S. in order to drag on the proceedings, and subsequently came to India and filed a false dowry harassment, claiming that in the life of the marriage, he had taken $12,000 from her after he had spent $500,000 in the divorce proceedings alone, and she had obviously spent a large amount of money as well. In India, again, he's been fighting the case now for 5 years and has spent approximately another 3 crores.
I haven't spent 3 crores in India, but this is, I'm counting, throwing in the money that I gave her over here. She took more than half a million dollars over here.
About 5 crores. And you've been accused of demanding $12,000.
Right.
Right. So, a lot of time and money is wasted in these kind of litigations, and still the father does not get access to the child. So, sir, do you want to elaborate on your meeting with Mr. Uday Ravi?
Yeah, so...
I have a small question for Ram. Did your wife work while she was in the U.S.?
Yes, she was working over here. She herself was earning around $86,000. I was making around $300,000 per year, and she was making $86,000 per year.
What was your wife's profession?
She was in IT business.
Okay. So, software engineer, obviously fairly well educated and successful as well. Not somebody who would classically associated giving dowry, etc.
I mean, we met here, we lived together here, and we got married after she became pregnant. So, I mean, imagine. There was no family involved, no parents involved.
Right. Absolutely.
So where was the question of dowry?
Ram, these things are already mentioned
in the case.
I think the point that these men want to make is that despite the fact that they go through very prolonged legal wrangles and spend a lot of money, despite everything, their anguish is not really the money and the time as much as the fact that they still denied access to their children. You know, after all this, one would expect that a person's natural right to be with his children, or at least meet his children, would...
So, I would just explain...
Satya, we are disconnected. Let me connect to Anupma again. Hello?
Yeah, Andy is actually connecting to Anupma, they got disconnected. I was actually just going to mention that Vaila Ravi said he cannot help us in any way and that he cannot afford to have women organizations
right.
in front of his office.
Uh-huh.
And I was totally stunned when he said that.
Right.
Yogesh? Sumesh?
Yeah, I think you got disconnected, so let me put you on the conference again.
Sure.
Widespread.
I'll just repeat what you said, Andy and Satya. Basically, what they're saying is they tried on several occasions to contact the Ministry of Overseas Legal Affairs. At each point of time, they have been not met with a positive response. And there is absolutely no forum wherein a man can go and lodge a complaint. I mean, there are 1,200 NGOs in India where women can go and lodge a complaint saying that they're being harassed, that they're facing domestic violence, that they have dowry accusations, etc., etc. There's not a single organization where a man can do that. And when he says we have 750 complaints, he's basically referring to Rakshak, which as an NGO receives complaints from men who have been falsely accused of either dowry or... Yes. Rakshak is, it's a registered NGO in California, USA.
So one thing that, you know, that I wanted to stress was...
Just a second.
Let the journalist also speak.
Yes. Have we... Satya?
Yeah, what's the question?
Have we written to the minister and received a response?
We have written to the minister, we have given the memorandum to the minister, we have written to the ministry several times, we have all the documents with us, we have not received a written response from the ministry yet.
Right, and some of us have written individually also by registered mail, you know, by certified mail, by FedEx, we've written and we've all have the receipts.
And we haven't had a response. However, this esteemed journalist who has asked this question, we can send all the documents we have sent to the ministry to date. And in fact, Anukma, there are four slides which actually summarizes all of our communications from Russia to the ministry.
Yeah.
Amongst the slides
that's on the Russia side?
That's from Russia, from 498.org. Yeah, that are Russia slides.
Actually, we had a representation in person where I and accompanied by three more people, we actually made a personal representation to the subcommittee which is looking into NRI marriages, where the secretary of Moria, Mr. Mal, was there as well. And so it was extremely hostile. We were not allowed to talk. Every time that I wanted to make a point, I was always told that you have 2 minutes to wrap up your presentation, please finish it. And it was palpably hostile, so certainly they don't want to hear what we have to say. We have all the information, we have all the written communications, everything has been uploaded on www.4988.org. If you just go to the site, you can see all the communications that have been sent by us to the ministry, but we have never ever got a written response from them.
And we have to understand it's not easy for them. There's so many posts reserved for any women or posts reserved for women rights activists. Nobody can dare to take them on. It's virtually impossible. Like this Women Commission Chairman, Urisha, she spoke out. So then she has to leave the post. Then we are saying that this Delhi Police Commissioner once said that more than half the rape cases are
elopement.
Because of that, he has to lose his job. But nobody can dare to say anything to them. Like they have passed a domestic violence law. This law, they have more than 10,000 posts are reserved for service providers, and the condition in the law for all these posts is you have to be a human rights activist as per Rule 206. So any of these who says anything against these 10,000 women would be the more they make noise in the press, they will get the next protection officer higher post. So you have to give one-sided views to get these posts.
That is why I'm asking.
Anukma, I would just ask a simple question.
Just a minute. There's somebody who wants to ask something. Just hold on.
Can the question be loudly spoken, please?
If you could move your mic.
Anupma will repeat the question. Don't worry.
Yeah, he's... Satya, sir, your name, please, sir. Mr. Jha wants to know if we've ever gone to the National Human Rights Commission with our complaints.
Okay, this is Satya. Several people have written to National Human Rights Commission, but they have not received a response.
Right. I was one person who wrote as well, didn't get anything back from them.
well, not as the organization, but as individual cases, a lot of us have actually tried and approached the National Human Rights Commission and have not received a response from them.
One of the victim mothers appealed to National Commission for Women. They gave a reply that as per our laws, you are not cannot look into your family.
No. About the National Human Rights Commission, there's at least one case that I definitely know about. There is a gentleman who lost his son because there was a false phone I made him. So he had a heart attack and died. They were residents of Chennai. Case was lost in Gujarat. Gujarat police came and, they had no jurisdiction. But the father, the husband's father was imprisoned and taken to Gujarat. Now, he has approached the National Human Rights Commission, and we know this for a fact because we have an entire case, which he sent to us as well. And we send them the entire case, then the police have accepted that what was done was completely ulterior and was wrong, and the Gujarat police has no jurisdiction to come to Chennai and imprison them. And despite all these facts being given, and despite the government, you know, officials actually saying that what was done was completely incorrect, NHRC actually had nothing to say about.
We have been approached by at least 3 different people in last 1 year who said that their mothers wrote to National Commission for Women for help when they were tortured by the husband's wife, and National Commission of Women said they cannot help the mother. As if mother is not a woman.
No. See, the what they are talking here about is really only National Human Rights Commission.
Sure.
So they're really interested knowing if Rakshak as an NGO has approached the NHRC.
Okay, no, Rakshak as an NGO has not yet approached NHRC, but Rakshak, on the other hand, has approached National Commission for National Protection of Child Rights, has written to the chairperson, Ms. Shanta Sinha, and as well as a couple of other people, and have sent a copy of that to Ministry of Home Affairs, Ministry of External Affairs, Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs, and Home Ministry. And we have not received any response till date. Those applications were made more than 1.5 months ago. Sumesh, you have more information on that?
Yeah, actually, this is with regards to the UN Convention on Rights of a Child, which India is a signatory to this convention. And it specifically states that the child should retain its identity and it should have contact with both parents. The reason we approached the National Commission for Protection of Child Rights because it is entrusted with the job for implementing the United Nations Convention on Rights of the Child. So far, we have not received any response, any formal response from them.
In fact, we wanted to meet with them when they had come to New York and they denied. They actually turned down our request to meet with the chairperson of National Commission for National Protection of Child Rights.
Right. I guess the point being made is that whatever channels were available under the democratic process, most of the channels have been explored, but we are still awaiting responses from quite a few of them. But all we are asking is a father's access to our kids.
Just a sec, please, we have a question. When did you meet Vayalar Ravi? Which hotel and what date?
Okay, so this is Satya. I met Mr. Vayalar Ravi on 29th of July in Los Angeles. If you give me a minute, I will give you the name of the hotel and the time as well.
Sure.
If you can take down the details of the person who's asking, we can email the details if it's not available right now.
Okay, we could email you all the details.
Also, I would like to mention here is in Chicago also on 6th or 9th of July, there was a news article that was published in Hindustan Times in which Vayalar Ravi was asked this question. question about what is he doing for to help the harassed husband. That question was asked in Chicago by a lady journalist named Vandana Jinghan. And he said, he asked that lady not to ask these questions in public.
Correct.
Can you repeat that for the audience?
I'll just repeat it. They met Vayalar Ravi in Chicago. No, twice they've met him. Once was in July in Los Angeles and the other time in Chicago. In Chicago,
and the third time actually was in New York at the Waldorf Astoria.
It was at New York?
We met with him in New York also at the Waldorf Astoria.
When was this?
This was Satya. Do you have that date handy?
Let me repeat. There were three different times during his visit in summer of 2006 when Vayalar Ravi was approached by three different groups. One was 29th of June in Los Angeles, California. Then 6th of July in New York.
And
then I think 9th or 10th of July in Chicago.
Okay, three different groups of people who met him on these different dates.
And now, all three of them had raised this point about harassment of NRI husbands by unscrupulous ladies by misusing the dowry provisions in India. And the third one that was in Chicago, this question was raised by the lady journalist Vandana Jinghan of TV Asia. And we have this press release also. I can send you the document right now if you want. This was published in the newspaper.
I'll get his email ID and you can send him all the details.
Sure.
Basically, when he was asked by a female reporter what he was doing about Harris Hartman, he said, do not ask me such questions in public. All right. Now, can we go on to the... Hold on. There's just one more question.
There's no question.
Sir, they've all read it. The first thing they do in the morning is they open and read.
They
know about it. Yes. Yes, they know about it. They're talking about the new change that has been proposed, removing the fare cap.
Yes, we are aware of it.
Yeah.
So, in fact, we'll talk about it later. So,
should we move on to the issue?
Yes, I think we should move to the Christie Daniels because it's,
right. You might have read media reports a bit about the Smalin Janita case. The story being told is that Smalin was pushed out of a moving car because her husband Christie and his family wanted money from her. And Smalin suffered extensive injuries and she is now being treated in India. Her father Sebastian has registered a case against Christie and his family for dowry harassment and torture. Also, MPW has taken up this case, and they have said that they refer it to the Minister of External Affairs, and they will go to the fullest. The word they use was that prosecuting Christie and his family will be their top priority, and they will even be Minister of Karunanidhi. So this is the story. But is that the truth? Is that maybe a cruel case of dowry torture where an innocent woman...
Andy, your voice is breaking actually.
That's okay. Right. It's echoing. Could you do something about it?
Is it better now?
Actually, this is not coming from Andy. It's probably coming from the speakerphone in the conference room. When he speaks,
there is no speakerphone here.
The conference room.
Is it still an echo?
In the conference room.
Okay, can we hear from Christy Daniels himself?
Right.
Hi, I'm
so. Yeah, go ahead, Christy.
Yeah, this is Christy Daniels. I mean, I just saw all the media reports and everything, and the propaganda that's been said. Actually, I just listed the chronology of the incident. Actually, I just quitted the company in July 27th, and then I need to join the new company in South Carolina on August 1st. So on 31st July, early morning, I just left the state, Ohio, and we started and then we headed up to Greenville, and my sister was a navigator. And we traveled on I-77 south and around, the afternoon, I met with an accident, and my sister and my wife Smalin Janita were thrown outside the car, and myself and my parents were trapped inside the car. And the EMS department came for the rescue within 2 minutes, and then they took us in an ambulance, and then we were in a hospital. And my sister as well as Smalin were airlifted to the Wake Forest University Hospital because that's a nearby trauma center. And my father and my mother were admitted over there through ambulance, and I was brought to the hospital by the nursing director, of a particular hospital, and there over there I was asked to sign a couple of documents concerning the operation on Smalin as well as my sister Lima. During that time, doctors were fighting to stop the blood on my father's right arm, and they did some operation, and the same day I informed my friends to inform the accident to all my relatives in India, especially Smalin's relatives and all my relatives over there in India, and it was informed. And on the next day, on August 1st, my in-laws gave me a call, and I explained about the serious condition of Smalin as well as my wife, as well as my sister. And I also told about my mother about the accident, and I was totally breaking off, so I couldn't talk to them more than half. So on the next day, that is on 2nd of August, there also I need to sign for a C2 fracture for my wife, Smalin. And one of my friends came to the hospital, and he gave a cell phone, and using that cell phone I updated all my family members concerning that. And I need to stay on that day with, in the patient waiting room for C2 fracture. And I spent the day over there. And on 3rd August, my sister came, doctors told that they are going to open the skull because the cerebral pressure inside the skull was developing, and they need to open the skull and then extract the pressure out of it. So I was just praying, at around in the evening, I signed for the operation, I signed for the operation on day one, but in the afternoon, on 3rd of August, she opened her eyes, and the doctors called me up, and they said, she opened her eyes, so, we need not perform the operation. So she was out of the coma, but she was unconscious at that time. She just opened her eyes. And on 18th August, Lima was discharged, my sister was discharged from the hospital. And on the same day, I had to wait for tracheotomy operation that was done on Smalin because she had a breathing tube that's been inserted through her mouth. So that was quite an uncomfort for her. So I need to sign for the tracheotomy operation that needs to be performed on her throat. And I was there for the whole day, until the evening, till the operation was performed. And on the next day, I brought my sister to the hospital operation. And she needs to be readmitted back to the hospital again due to an emergency. And she was discharged on 20th of August. And my father was discharged on 27th of August. I just brought him to using the wheelchair. That's the way he can move. And I brought him to my home. And till first week of September 2007, Smalin's relatives were regularly in touch with me, especially his elder brother, Justin Vasundaraj. He was in constant touch with me, and Smalin's uncle, Regis, who was in Chennai, he was also in touch with me, and Thomas.
Let me interrupt you, Krishna, here. So far, what you're saying is that your family also suffered extensive injuries in the accident.
Yes.
You had kept Smalin's relatives totally informed of the incidents that have been happening. Would that be right, somebody?
Pardon? Your voice is breaking.
Okay, go ahead then.
Yeah, your voice is breaking, okay. And then, when Smalin was in coma, there were several instructions that has been given to me through the doctors. And it's a list says about, I need to continuously talk to her. Though she was in coma, I just narrated some incidents between us. And then, I tried to stand nearby her, and I used to talk for hours. And then, I used to keep some, my MP3 player with songs that she likes. And I used to make it a point that it's been played on her ears. And once, even a nurse helped me out to replace the AAA battery in the MP3 player. And as per the osteology doctor's instruction, as given that, I used to remove the gloves on her right hand because she had the involuntary action wherein, she used to remove the catheter tube, and once she removed the feeding tube off of her body. So they gave a neck gloves on her right hand, and it was tied to it. And I used to give some stretching exercise by removing the gloves. And, I used to give the stretching exercise for her palms and the fingers for the blood movement. And I also used to monitor the traction unit because they kept the traction to heal the fractures on its own. Rather than doing some operation, they want to keep the traction to heal it on its own in a faster track. And also used to monitor the foot pad that was kept. And I also, since one of the nurses, once it happened, the traction bolt, that has got some bruises on our superior region of the leg. And because of that, I just told her, give some clearance between the traction and the leg. And that's the way
it went. Christy, can you hear me?
Yes, I could hear you.
Okay, so essentially what you're saying is that your family met with an accident, and your relatives, your mother, your father, and your sister were also injured, and your sister was also in coma, and you informed, and Smalin also suffered serious injuries, and you informed her relatives as well, and you were taking good care of her as per the doctor's orders. So tell us what happened when her father, Sebastian, joined in the U.S.
Actually, till then, Sebastian came to U.S. in the month of September, that is on 23rd, when myself and my sister went to meet, when I went to see Smalin. Actually, there was a rose pot being kept nearby her bedside, and I asked the nurse who came over here, and they responded that her father came over here along with half a dozen people, along with the security, along with the security force. So I just went to the patient relationship department to inform, there were some couple of issues that he raised, that I came to know through some of my friends, and this is what has happened, and there are certain things which I can't disclose it at this picture, because I have the evidence with me, I don't like to disclose on that, but I know that on September he came over here, because I got information from the nurse in acute care.
I see. So what happened after he came in September?
After he came over here, through his relatives, like the in-laws, Smalin's two elder brothers and Aunt Sylvia and her son Melvin Peter came along with some gundas, and then they came to our house, they snapped out the telephone line, and they peeked inside the house, and they threatened my grandfather as a knife edge, and he was beaten up along with my grandmother, and they were kidnapped over in the auto, and they were sent to the Nagarkoil bus. And they warned them, if you ever turn up to Trichy, you will get killed out. And they also threatened them, saying that I need to accept for the guardianship change towards Sebastian. And he also said that, are you trying to kill my sister with the help of hospital? And this is the exact statement he has threatened my grandfather.
I see. So
and I also informed the whole incident to the patient relationship department director, and she knows it.
I see. So did you finally change your guardianship to Sebastian?
Yeah, I was forced to do that change because, I got threatening calls from India, especially from our in-laws like, Sylvia and her grandfather, who is...
Christy,
yes.
Christy, just give me a minute. Can you just let me summarize, because they really can't understand, what you're saying. So very quickly, please, just correct me if I'm wrong anywhere. Happened is 31st July, Christy, along with his family members, was in a car. They met with an accident. In the accident, his father was seriously injured. He's in fact paralyzed in the right half of his body and has only now begun to regain some function. His sister had suffered a fracture of the skull and was also bleeding internally. So she had a hemorrhage for which she had to be operated upon in the U.S. and his wife also suffered some injuries. So it is not as painted out to be in the media here, and it's not as if the complaint that she was pushed out of a running car. In fact, they met with an accident and all his family members were previously injured. They were all hospitalized from 31st of July onwards, and she was hospitalized until September when her father...
Yes. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Wait, we have lost her. One sec. Let me try to... Yeah, we have lost her, so let me try to reconnect.
Christy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Christy, whenever Andy tries to summarize something, that means he's yes. trying to put you back on track, so please listen to him.
Okay.
Okay. And also, what you need to emphasize here is that your family suffered a lot of problems. They were also injured. That has not been even mentioned by the media. You have to say that your sister was in hospital in coma for a month, and all those things you have to mention. And that as a good husband, you try to take care of your wife as much as you could while you were trying to search for a and as a job, you were out of the job. You have to mention these things more.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the document, but I mean...
You have to say these things, right?
Sure.
So, you say, you know, your own family, media has not even tried to understand the plight you went through when your whole family, along with your wife, your sister, your parents, they were all in the mad accident and they were in the hospital. You have to mention all that.
Yes.
Probably none of you would know that my sister also met the accident. Your father, your mother, everyone was involved in the accident, were in the in coma and were in the hospital for months. You have to mention all this. That those things have not been even mentioned to the media. I would request the media to even ask these people. Right?
Okay.
Yeah. Don't get tense. Be wary and don't get tense and mention these things that you have, you know, somebody should actually approach the patient care department and ask them how much, how well you took care of your wife, all those things. And till the point you were actually requested to give the guardianship over to the father. And that he was in the US for 3 months or whatever number of months before he flew to India.
Yes.
Mention all that. Okay, Andy? Who else is there in the conference right now?
This is
Hello,
Dinesh.
This is Anand.
Anand, okay.
This is Dinesh.
Sorry.
Okay.
Hey, Satya, I'm you dialing back.
Okay.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello.
Andy, are you conferencing?
Andy, still there?
Okay, cool. Hello, we're connected to India now.
Okay. So, my... Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. As per the medical report, actually, Alan...
Wait. So, let me try to call them again, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so, Christy, before you join, before you start thing, I'll try to summarize these things and you build on the story then, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Let me try to summarize these things.
Hey, Satya?
Yeah?
Are you familiar with the Christie's story?
I am somewhat familiar. Who is this?
Yeah, this is Shani here.
Shani, yeah.
I would suggest, why don't you, you know, like, ask, I think, some, you know, general questions to Christy, and he can fill in those, and, you know, just sort of guide the, basically, into it. And, you know, sort of interview him, you know, since you have an idea, and guide him, you know, through the, like, you know, through the, basically,
sure,
chain of
it. I'll try to do that, you know, but, you know, journalists have a very small attention span, so that's why I thought I'll just summarize a little bit, so that, to put everything back on track, and then I'll ask questions.
Because I think he has been, you know, because he has been affected, so he tends, I mean, he's going into detail, which is fine, but at the same time, we may have to, you know, surface out and show it, you know, and you might be able to do that.
Sure.
Better. All right. Just a suggestion. And if Christy, I mean, Christy, you may, if you like the suggestion.
Christy, your sister is there too, right?
Yes, she is also there.
Yeah, so I would actually let her speak also. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Anupma, are you there? And Lima, when basically when you were speaking, you mentioned that you were also, you know, in a coma for more than a month, and you know, your brother getting all these allegations and all that, and you can let journalists ask questions and all.
Okay, we are now connecting to India.
Okay.
Right.
Thing is that they have to understand that Indian troops also have their own jurisdiction.
Indian courts, legislating in the courts are not dharmadikaris, they are hands are tied and they just follow the rules laid down and the rules you also target that is for NDA.
So therefore we are actually targeting legislation, not...
But I not appreciate it. I beg for the time. What positive, what constructive, what powerful effort has been made by the NGO for any of these victims?
Okay, I'd like to answer that, sir, because, well,
I'll give you the best.
Okay.
My problem is that I'm going to come back to them. I have the right to you.
Right.
Of me. I understand that all of them are disappointed.
So then, how does constitutional amendment come about? So how does one raise this in parliament? Can you go to the parliament other than as a visitor? You cannot. Media can. So we meet in media first.
Media can help you.
Right. Which is why we're having a press. Okay, sir. What would you suggest we do? Right. So where would you suggest we go? Where would you suggest we take this? So why would it hurt us? We want to know where we should take it. So you're just speaking but not answering our question. You've raised a problem.
Anupma, can we actually take this question offline and get more questions? I understand this is an important question, but we can take this question offline also.
Yeah, listen, the question is that we are not doing the right thing and we should be raising our voice to the parliament. That is the question. And whatever.
Okay, let me answer. This is Satya.
Let me answer it because I've been a part of all our, you know, whatever attempts we've made. Okay. We've made several attempts. And you said that your working is not correct. Our first representation was to the Committee on Ministry of Home Affairs, which was looking at a review of the Criminal Procedure Code. So the first presentation was to that committee, which was headed by Mrs. Sushma Swaraj. And we were very disappointed, we got a good hearing, we presented our entire case with statistics, with hardcore statistics, which proved our point. So, what we've moved to Parliament to
the point.
What is that process? We want to know from you. Yes, we have. Several. No. When we moved to Ministry of Home Affairs, no, the committee, after hearing everything, their recommendation was make it compoundable. Now, making it compoundable makes it much, much worse. Making it compoundable means that the girl only has to now include 20 more people in her complaint, take money now from, instead of one person, take it from 20 people and compound them and say, okay, I withdraw the case against them if they give me 20 lakhs each. Sorry.
Yeah, if I may interject here, can people hear me?
No, we've done it in person.
Okay. And you are not going to be responsible to the
RTI. Yes.
You could have resorted to RTI.
We have resorted to several RTIs. How do you know we haven't done it?
So, I think, let me interject here. I think the press conference is to highlight the problems that NRIs face as fathers and where they're denied access to children. I think the issue is not...
You cannot just say you're not working because we have done a lot. You have
so I think, Anupma, can you hear me?
Just a second. Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically this press conference is to highlight the plight of the fathers who have lost touch with their children and also give some more input about the Christy Daniels case. This is not a platform to discuss Raksha Bandhan activities and we can take it outside.
So that's right, but... Okay, all right. Is there... Yeah, NDTV is here, and is there any queries for Christy Daniels? Full screening. See, Christy, the case is sub judice. Christy may not be able to answer all of your questions if his lawyer has asked him not to. If it's pertinent to his case, he may not be, but as far as possible, we'll try and clarify, you know, whatever queries you may have. So you can... Christy, this is for you.
Yes, Anuma. Yeah.
Yeah, the question... Was there an ongoing problem regarding dowry between your two families? Was there a feud?
No, never. We never accepted any bit of money from their family as regarding dowry. Not even a single penny.
Well, not a single penny of dowry was ever taken.
Never. Because since 2000, that is the year I joined my company.
One second, Christy, there's another question. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what Mr. Jangiani wants to know is why then would her father file a police complaint alleging dowry harassment? Why do you think he did it?
Actually, why he didn't do it in USA? Because he was here in, he came over here in September 23rd and till November 14th he was over here. And why he didn't whisper a word regarding harassment to the magistrate when he signed for the change of guardianship?
Absolutely.
Very well, he had a cell phone. He can very well call 911 service.
No.
Concerned with the dowry harassment or if it is an attempt to murder as he portrays in India. Why he didn't do or whisper a single word over here?
Why do you think her father put in a complaint at all about dowry allegation, accusation? Why at all did he do it? Was there any other issue?
There were some marriage disputes. Before the marriage, actually, there were some marriage disputes where actually we did a background check of their family and we discovered a hell lot of shocking news and we did something to stop the marriage. But the thing is that our aunt Sylvia threatened our family members that if at all if we go and stop the marriage, we will file a dowry harassment case against you. And her younger brother is in DSP and using his power, they can do anything. And they also have some relationship with local rowdies in Trichy. So it was all a threatening thing and it was a complete game plan. They played it and lost against me.
Can I just repeat what
Christy says
is that there were little issues, there were some disputes. Apparently, they've done a check on the family and discovered some not very pleasant facts about them. They had decided to, in fact, not go ahead with the marriage. At which point in time, they were threatened that if they did not go ahead with the marriage, they would be accused in a false 498. So he did go ahead and marry her. There were issues in the marriage, and subsequently this accident was painted out to be a dowry harassment case. Is that correct?
Yes, Anupama. And this I never thought that an accident would be, after doing an investigation, they issued the accident report over here. And in spite of providing all the proof, there's nothing that has happened over there in India. And using the NDW people, they did some pressure in the political background.
Let Anupama answer that.
Christy, there's another question. So if you could just... yes, so this is from NDTV and they want to know...
Yes, Anupama.
I'm going to
We've also met the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs because they had again set up a subcommittee looking at NRI marriages. So we've been making representations wherein we go with our statistics. Wherever when you talk about misuse of 498A, the sort of blanket reply that you get is, this is all hearsay, there are no statistics to back up what you're saying that is being misused. So we have a bank of statistics now wherein we work out that 498A is grossly misused. And the conviction in 498A when the woman is alive is only 2%. 98% of all cases that are registered are false. We have gone with these statistics to the legislators. If it's statistics and evidence that they want, we've shown them plenty. Now it's up to them to actually take the call whether they want to do something about it. The second prong, the second kind of people that we want to influence is, of course, the judiciary. Now, for that, there was a committee which was headed, which was the Madhav Menon Committee, which was looking at reviewing the criminal jurisprudence. We've made a representation to them as well. And when they came out with their report, in fact, unfortunately, the same story was repeated again, which is that women have been tortured for centuries, et cetera, so the law should not be diluted. So obviously, there is a strong lobby that is also working against diluting these laws. So despite all the evidence that we have produced, we've not been able to make headway. And the third, of course, is the press. The media, which is also very important in, again, raising this issue both in front of legislators, judiciary, as well as the common man. So this is what we're doing. So this is our three-pronged attack. And finally, the last thing that we tackle is we bring more awareness. And so if you just go to our site, you'll see that we've got, we've tried and given the common man a lot of advice, whether it's legal, whether it's coming from people who are fighting their cases, so we try to help the common man and also bring in more awareness as to how he could be implicated in a false case as well, and how these laws are so lopsided and so gender biased that you have practically, no respite.
So yeah, I would like to add a little bit of something here. I had met along with eight other people in California with the sitting Chief Justice of Karnataka High Court named Cyrus Joseph, who had asked us to mention to Vela Ravi, because we mentioned to him that we are meeting with the minister tomorrow, and he mentioned, tell Vela Ravi that 498A is the single most abused law.
www.thisisrecall.com. Please enter your conference access code, followed by the pound key. This menu will repeat. You entered 951636. If this is correct, press 1. To re-enter your access code, press 2. There are 7 other callers on the call. Conference options have now changed. At any time, press star 4 for conference instructions. Please announce yourself.
Be nice.
Please answer this gentleman's question. Hello, ma'am.
He said that... Okay, listen.
Wife actually accidentally fell from
Thank you.